Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Double X is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code Double X at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. And by BowlandBranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Get the nicest sheets you've ever owned for about half the price of what stores and boutiques are charging. Order right now and they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. Go to BowlandBranch.com, that's BOLLANDBRANCH.com, and use the promo code XX. And by The Message, a new podcast series from GE Podcast Theater.
Hi, Nikki Tomlin here, and I'm the host of The Message. I'll be following a team of elite cryptographers as they decode a highly classified radio transmission. To sum it up, extraterrestrials. The Message on iTunes.
Hey, Panoply listener, looking for more podcasts for your playlist? Check out the Vulture TV podcast for great discussion about the latest TV shows, or check out Sex Lives for fascinating conversations about sex. You can find them on iTunes, Panoply.fm, or on your favorite podcasting app.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, October 15th, the Fart of the Eye edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and The Atlantic. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi.
Before we get going, we need a new intern. So if you are interested, please email us at xxgabfest@slate.com. Make the subject line intern and tell us what you like about the show, don't like about the show, and why you want the job. Also, we need interns to attend tapings either in D.C. or New York on Wednesdays. So just be aware of that when you apply. Okay, our three topics. First, crying in a professional setting. Can John Boehner do it, but not Hillary? Can they both do it? What does it mean? Second, Playboy stops publishing nude pictures. What is that about? And bangs, they are everywhere and they are mocking us. I'm really excited to talk about bangs, I have to say, because I don't understand bangs.
I'm really excited to finally learn what the hell they are.
I'm excited to defend bangs against all comers.
But you don't have bangs.
I do. They're just pinned back all the time.
Mm-hmm. Wait, Noreen totally has bangs.
Yeah.
See, I don't really know what bangs are.
All right, let's jump in with crying. John Boehner cried after meeting the Pope. He cries all the time. Sometimes people find it cute and charming. Sometimes he gets mocked for it. Hillary has cried in the past in public a couple of times, and mostly voters like when she does that. In general, are you allowed to cry in a professional setting, and are the rules different for men and women? Okay, can I run a theory by you guys about the Democratic debate this week?
Please do.
Yeah, okay. So it is my theory, because it's related to this topic, I promise, that what people are looking for always in Hillary is so much less her actual positions on topic than her emotional tone. Like, was her emotional tone correct? Like, the first question out of the box was designed to make her really defensive. And some of the guys were defensive. Like, why aren't you calling on me? I'm just standing here. You know, like, there was definitely that going on. And then, like, Jim Webb, who's hilarious. And then, you know, Bernie Sanders, who, like, what would it take to make the man smile or laugh or, like, give one hint about his personal life? Like, I kept thinking, is there anything I could do to, like, make him laugh? Any joke I could tell? You know, no. But with Hillary, I feel like what people will remember about the debate is, like, you know, that she gave off the right emotional tone. Like, she wasn't defensive and she seemed really smart and, you know, but she wasn't know-it-all-y. Like, that's what we're always reading Hillary for.
I think that's true. And I also think, though, that one of the people you didn't mention, Martin O'Malley, he came off as one of those emotional guys, not quite Boehner level. You know, it's only like, he didn't need a tissue, but you almost had the sense at a couple of points that he might have to pull one out at some point, maybe during the break, just to kind of get a little bit of sort of built up, you know, tear fluid out of his the corner of his eye. He always seems on the point of breaking down or just kind of getting verklempt or something.
But the sentimental guy is like a type of guy, right? Like, that's a category of American man who can get very sentimental. I mean, if you ever read a list of the things John Boehner cries about, it's kind of hilarious, you know?
Anything.
Yeah, it's just, but it's just like so many varied things. Like there's a ceremony for the golf legend Arnold Palmer, and he cries. It's like the unveiling of a Rosa Parks statue. He cries. You know, it talks about his dad. I guess that one makes more sense, or his family, and he cries. He just cries. Like, this is a sentimental guy. That's okay.
Do you think they're genuine tears in all cases? Like, do you think Arnold Palmer really makes him tear up, or do you think it's a little bit of a politician putting on a show of authenticity?
I think it's totally real, because no way a guy would want to be quite so teary.
Yeah.
I mean, his mother, his father, maybe Rosa Parks, but nobody would want to cry for Arnold Palmer. And, you know, and I think it's so over the top, too. I mean, I guess he also gets mocked for his orangeness, and he still stays orange. So I suppose, you know, maybe he doesn't care about what the things that people make fun of him for. But I don't know if anybody saw the interview that he did with John Dickerson on Face the Nation. And it was just after the Pope had visited, and he was, you know, he'd announced his retirement. And it just, like, he really was on the point of tears at every single question. I mean, it didn't matter almost what John asked him. He just is constantly on the point of tears. But it's so extreme that it's just like, you know, say having a stutter or something. Like, it clearly is beyond his power to do anything about it. And it's not ideal. And it may not have been perfect for his career, but it's just part of his makeup.
I find it very endearing, actually.
Yeah.
Which maybe has something to do with his gender. I mean, I don't agree with his politics, but, like, John Boehner as a person seems like he has some moral core, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of some kind. And I think some of that for me is tied up with knowing some things about his religiosity, and just, like, he just seems to be a person who cares deeply about things, and I like that.
Right.
And I like a lot of American voters, I like seeing that in politicians. And so that's my question on Hillary is, okay, are we looking for her emotional tone because she's a woman, or are we looking at her emotional tone because we are worried about her authenticity and her performance of authenticity and whether she does it well?
See, I think crying is really, really symbolic and weighted, but also really, really contextual, right? Like the kind of crying no one can stand and which makes everyone ill is just absolutely phony crying. Like sure. the example is Bill Clinton at Ron Brown's funeral. I don't know if you guys remember that, but like he was just palling around with someone and then the camera caught him and he turned around and just like immediately like fake cried, like instantly on cue fake cried. And it's just like the ultimate example of the kind of crying that everyone thinks is somewhat despicable, right? So that's like off the table.
Except I also have kind of like, really? You can cry on cue? If you can manage that, that's like a next level of like self-control and skill.
Sociopathy.
Yes. Well, except
or acting.
Yeah,
but.
Exactly. I mean, that's just, I mean, and it was funny that you mentioned acting because it's in a weird, I think, probably two-pat way. Sometimes when you go to a play and you see someone cry real tears in an emotional moment, you think, wow, they're a great actor. And I'm not sure that's really true. All that really proves is that they can cry on command. But I never have had that thought with Boehner. And the thing that typically I find grating of Hillary, even though I know I like her more than you guys do, but is that her laugh when she's in a situation like a debate, that comes off to me as fake. Because really, why would you laugh in a situation like that when you are, you know, yes, you know them and yes, there's a certain collegiality, but you're also like, you would claw each other's eyes out if you could. And why are you going, you know, it's just not. It's not convincing.
But she had a couple of, like, genuine jokes and zingers in there. Like, not a lot, you know? Like, when she came back from the bathroom or, like, her thing at the end was, like, you know, about how many enemies she had.
But you know that there are times when she's laughing and it is not real.
Right. Well, let's talk about Hillary. Like, let's talk about women and crying. Like, if you look in the business press, the cliche out there is just, you know, women can't really cry at the office. It's not good. It freaks out the men. And then there'll be some bullshit science about testosterone, you know, goes down and the men get threatened. You know, that stuff, like science says, is sort of bullshitty. But like there is that stereotype. And then there's Sheryl Sandberg came in and leaned in and said, you know, no, it's okay to cry at the office. So when is it okay to cry at the office? Like, have you guys ever cried in a professional setting?
In front of people?
Yes. Yeah, people have to see it. It can't be like in the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the bathroom, that's just all the time.
Like another Tuesday.
Yeah.
Sometimes she steps away between segments to pop to the bathroom for a good cry.
The only time I can recall crying in a professional setting was very early in my career when I was, I don't know, maybe 23. And I had summoned up my courage to ask for a raise.
Oh.
And I was making very little money in New York City, like so little that I think probably my employers assumed I had a trust fund, which I do not. So I asked for a small raise and my boss said no. And I just was so like hurt. And in that moment, I just started to tear up. I didn't actually cry, but I'm sure he could tell because, you know, he emailed a few hours later, maybe the next day, and said, you know, you can have a couple thousand dollars more a year. Which was
yes,
like,
it worked.
It was like pity. And it like, but at that time, a couple thousand dollars a year was like fantastic and a game changer. And I was so embarrassed. And that is the only time, well, whatever, that just not a good lean in moment. But I guess it did work. I cringe thinking about it now. And I teared up in front of my boss and got a raise.
That is so interesting. First of all, did you read Jennifer Lawrence's thing about Hollywood and like how much money she made versus how much her male co-stars made? That was really interesting. That was good. That was good.
Yeah. Well, so back to my...
Just back to your story. I was curious about it because essentially that's like a dynamic. That's a dynamic that happens in the movie The Intern. So the Jules, the Anne Hathaway character, who is Jules, Robert De Niro, who represents a kind of gentlemanly old style man, his protective instinct and his desire to want to help her and make her succeed is triggered when he sees her crying. And that is an old-fashioned dynamic of a man wanting to protect a woman because he always has a handkerchief in his pocket. But it's actually good. Like, it leads to success for everyone. It leads to him in a kind of feminist way helping her get what she wants, which is somewhat similar to what happened in your case, but not really.
Yeah, and according to, you know, sort of business school studies, male managers respond a lot better than female managers do to a woman crying in the office, which I think might have something to do with the exact thing that you just talked about. I think maybe female managers are like, you know, get your shit together, girl. Like, you're in the office. Don't sort of betray us in this weak way. I wonder whether people feel more or less comfortable crying in front of a male or female manager, whether there's some instinct in people that understands, you know, how receptive people might be.
That's really interesting and horrifying. I personally never cry. The only things that make me cry are the Parade of Nations in the Olympics and Sports Illustrated magazine. Otherwise, I never, ever cry.
Like the sob stories? Like Johnny got some skates and then his dad died?
I know. It's the most pathetic thing. But they used to always have Sports Illustrated on the plane, and I would just like pick it up and look at it, and I would be within seconds I'd be like sobbing my eyes out, and the people were like,
are you serious? But people cry more on planes. That's a whole thing.
Is that right?
because of the atmospheric pressure. That's why you watch a stupid movie on the plane and you end up crying. It's like, people, there have been studies.
Wait, what science did you just drop because of the atmospheric pressure?
Science. Someone told me that in a bar once. Okay. This is where basically all my science comes from.
You said it in that voice, like, yo, people cry more on airplanes because of atmospheric pressure.
It's true. I think Google it.
Google it, people. But here's the thing.
June, I'm really sorry. I'm just kind of stuck on this. What do you mean you cry because reading Sports Illustrated?
The stories, I find, like, the emotionality of the stories. And there's something about, it's weird, because I'm the most unathletic person you can imagine. But there's something about those stories, which, you know, there's a completely predictable narrative about, you know, the people working hard and struggling, and it's really difficult, and they're you know, there's four people that could have won that gold medal, and they're the one that crossed the line first. That narrative just gets to me, and I have no idea why, but that's the thing that can get me to just, or really the Olympics. I just really need to think about the Olympics, and I just get a little bit verklempt, but it's silly.
No, that is so nice. No, that's like a deep, that's like the hero stories for the American tribe. That's just a testimony to how deep some narratives are in the human psyche.
Right, except that there's also like a slightly psychopathic element to my not crying, because really I could experience like huge personal loss and just be like, oh, well, there we go.
No, I think a lot of people just have a different connection between their emotions and their bodies.
Right.
Actually, this is actual science that I wrote down, which is that in general, you are the exception, but in general, women physiologically just need to cry more than men because they have shallower tear ducts.
Oh my God.
Seriously.
Stop it.
So according to this tear scientist at Tilburg University, Dr. Vingerhutz.
That's not a real place.
Vingerhutz, who is the author of the book, Why Only Humans Weep, Unraveling the Mysteries of Tears. Anyway, this guy says that women cry 30 to 64 times a year. And men cry just 6 to 17 times per year.
Wow, I only cry once every 4 years when it's the Olympics.
You're bringing down the average, June. On the other hand, I will say I cry all the time. Like, the joke in my family is I was like sobbing watching Wreck-It Ralph, honestly.
I don't even know what that is.
Right, because it's like a dumb children's movie. And I was sobbing in the movie theater. I always cry.
Professionally?
Okay, I'm going to tell you this is my like mortifying professional crying story. It's really bad. I might have told you guys this before, but when I was a young reporter, I had to interview Barney Frank, and I was working at the New Republic, and I had like my questions prepared, and I can't for the life of me remember what the subject was, but I went into his congressional office, and I was all dressed up, and everyone was there in their congressionally situation, and he just lit into me in the way only Barney Frank can. Like, he was like, that is a stupid question. I can't believe you're starting with that. I mean, he's like Tourette-ic in the way that he goes after people. And I started crying. Oh. Like, I got so flustered. I started, really crying. And I could not stop. Oh, like, I couldn't get it together. I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't get out any questions. It was horrible. Oh. And I had to, like, make my way out of the congressional office. It was really bad. God, just, like, thinking about it today today makes me just like cringe and my skin crawl. It was very, very bad crying moment. Now, that is bad crying because it's not in the context. He doesn't know me. He doesn't know anything about me. It's not like a situation at work that can lead to some kind of interesting breakthrough or anything like that where people realize, like, you know, this situation is really frustrating. We have to do something different. It's just like horrible.
Although
horrible,
I have to say,
losing it.
My gay brother made kind of a dick move there, though, like just lighting into you. What the hell was that about? Like, okay,
he
dumb
does
question.
That.
Yeah, but that's not okay.
How did he
no.
react?
No,
was he, nice
he does.
After you cried or no?
No. No, he just like it shocked me. Like you don't expect a congressman. I didn't know enough about him. I mean, you can hear a million stories from reporters about Barney Frank like this, but I didn't know that much about him. I didn't know that that was his habit, and that's what he did. And I was so surprised and taken aback. And like when you're a young reporter interviewing a congressman, you're like very like, here it is. I'm nervous. Like mm-hmm. I've got to, you know, get through my questions so I can write my story. And oh God, it was the worst.
See, I not being an office crier or any kind of crier. I've heard still a lot of people, a lot of women have told me, no men have ever told me, but a lot of women have told me that this is something that in like vocal fry, except real and something that they give a shit about, like this is something that they really can't control. And that's what makes it so annoying and frustrating and a problem, because it's a reaction that is physical, that kind of is awkward, that especially in an interview situation or in a professional situation, just, you know, makes a comment on you that you that just feels out of your hands. And especially the kind of people who are very high achieving, you know, got into the great schools that they apply to and have kind of done everything that they want to do. The fact that they can't control their, you know, their tear ducts, that makes them crazy. But it also is frustrating because, well, how do you address that? How do you stop crying?
Well, the great New York City reality TV star / power publicist Kelly Catrone has some advice for all of us in the title of her memoir from, I don't know, 2008, which is, if you have to cry, go outside, which I think is a great title for a memoir and good advice. Although in that moment, it can be difficult to do, I suppose. Mm. But, you know, not just the bathroom. People can overhear you in the bathroom. Go all the way outside.
Huh. But, you know, okay, we'll end this topic. But don't you think, isn't there something sort of, you know, isn't there some pathos in this idea that you cannot help it? It's about your tear ducts, if we're going to believe Dr. Schwitzer-Kreil. And nonetheless, like people invest so much meaning into it. Like she must be out of control. She must not be able to handle this job. When really it's just like some kind of like fart of the eye. You know what I mean? It's not, it doesn't, not necessarily meaningful. It's just like a thing you can't, it's not meaningful that I'm sobbing during Wreck-It Ralph. It's just a thing that happens, like John Boehner.
Yeah, I think it is meaningful. First of all, it usually is connected to emotions or maybe, frankly, hormones sometimes. That is a whole thing that we haven't really addressed. But I think, you know, men or sort of more stoic women are also experiencing this frustration at work, probably, but they're channeling it in different ways. And there is something cathartic about letting out some tears. I actually really liked this part of Sheryl Sandberg's book where she essentially says, use tears to your benefit, like make them power tears. And I don't know that I could ever do that, although maybe I did unintentionally in that, you know, sort of ask for a raise moment when I was 23. But I think, you know, there is opportunity for the women of the world to reclaim crying and to let John Boehner be our lodestar.
Well, I'm just going to point out that I was just, in the last couple of days, I've just been watching television, and I swear every drama has a man crying at some point. I mean, it was also in The Intern. At one point, Robert De Niro was watching a movie, an old like Gene Kelly movie, and he gets a little, you know, a little bit of waterworks. You're thinking of his deceased wife and so on. But that's now like the erd guy thing on television is like if you can cry looking at your kid or if you can get upset, that's now something that's considered super attractive in a guy. It like shows that you have deep emotions. Noreen is pulling a face that makes me think that she's not so keen on crying dudes.
It's no, I like crying dudes. No, it's not true. My worst first date story ever is a guy who cried. And I love telling people that story in part just for the reaction of other women, which is always just like utter disgust.
Oh,
they're like,
God.
How could he show those emotions on a first date?
Wow. Can you tell us the story quickly?
Later.
Please.
Did you punch him in the face?
I was an empathetic listener and it brought tears out in him. That is all I'll say.
Wow.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Maybe we should cut that part, please.
No. All right. Let's move on to our next topic, Playboy. But before we do, we would like to thank Squarespace. As I've said before, I've built a fabulous gaming site with my son on squarespace.com, which makes it very easy to set up. My son is a coder, but I am not. And Squarespace allowed us to work on the site together because it's easy to use, it's intuitive, and it looks really good. It starts at $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you sign up for a year. Start your free trial site today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. And when you sign up, make sure to use the offer code double X spelled out, that's DOUBLEX, to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Okay, let's move on to our next topic, Playboy. Playboy just announced that it will stop publishing naked pictures. This marks the end of an era, or a recognition that the era has long ended. So let's talk about what it means. First, why don't we just do the basics. Why did they do it? Why did Playboy say that they were no longer going to publish nude pictures?
Just business. Their circulation has fallen from 5.6 million copies in 1975 to about 800,000 now. Last year, or a little while ago, they stopped having completely nude photos online, and their audience jumped. I think it jumped fourfold, and the average age went from like late 40s to early 30s. There are lots of, so it seems it's about business. You know, if you have online at least, if you have naked people, you can't share on Facebook and Instagram because they don't allow nipples. And there's just too much competition from, you know, free sites online. People now really are going to be buying Playboy for the articles.
Yeah. It's funny though, did you guys read the online Playboy?
No.
It was sort of a little bit like Wired mixed with Maxim. There was like a story on Ruth Bader Ginsburg and then the 8 sexiest planets and then the man who saved beer pong. It was interesting. Noreen, do you know any young guys who read Playboy? Like, I wonder why a young guy would read Playboy. Is it for nostalgia? Is it like a camp irony thing where you're trying to go back to that era?
I don't think that I do. I feel like no one would tell you that. Like, young men actually are somewhat open about their porn consumption, but I don't think Playboy is sort of on the menu. But I do think people love the old issues in kind of a camp way, like you said, more an appreciation, because if you look at them now, they are sort of, you know, mid-century stylish and almost sweetly innocent compared to a lot of what's out there. And so people, you know, will go thrifting and love to find a cachet of old Playboys.
I went into a hipster store somewhere in Brooklyn. I just like wandered aimlessly in there looking for a present.
Sure.
And it was like flannel shirt. No, it was for dudes. It wasn't for girls. It was a flannel shirts and flasks and stacks of old Playboys.
Yeah.
Like that was the vibe.
Performative masculinity.
Yeah.
For people who cry on the first date.
Yeah. All right. So when I was delving into the Playboy subject, I have to, like, I actually had like a great amount of, I didn't cry, I didn't get weepy, but I did feel the nostalgia pretty hard. Huh. And here's why I felt the nostalgia. I felt like Hugh Hefner in the early days, and just like his whole philosophy, his whole sort of lifestyle. What's that famous Playboy? It's a famous founding quote in the first issue. If you're a man between the ages of 18 and 80, Playboy is meant for you. We enjoy mixing up cocktails and hors d'oeuvre or two, putting a little mood music on the phonograph, and inviting in a female acquaintance for a quiet discussion on Picasso, Nietzsche, jazz. Okay, here's why I like that. Because it was like this idea that creating a fantasy, which is what he was doing in his Playboy clubs, was incredibly arduous and difficult and artistic work. You know, it required like some intellectual development, some music. It wasn't like just creating a fantasy is just like clicking on youporn.com for
10 seconds and then done. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's
yeah.
something like kind of lovely about that, that like it takes a lot of work to make a fantasy real. It's almost like Disney, you know? It is like Disney. It's like the Disney of sex and just like everything just perfectly curated. And, you know, this is difficult work. It's not that it was respectful to women, because it clearly was not. It was all creating a fantasy for men. But it still had a depth to it that sex, that porn doesn't have at all anymore.
Yeah, and there wasn't a ton of evidence that that's what, I mean, that's kind of what they're trying to go back to. And I do think that would be a better and more interesting business strategy than trying to just, you know, make viral articles on the internet like everyone else, you know, sort of creating a mood again, almost the old-fashioned pinup as like a chaste kind of sex object. I don't know. I think they could get more cultural traction by doing that.
I mean, I completely get that urge that you're describing, Hannah, but it does feel like what's really going on with Playboy is they're just squeezing the last drops of, you know, viability out of this brand. I mean, the magazine might be in the crapper and the subscription, you know, it's losing something like $3 million a year in the U.S., but worldwide, it's just still this, you know, that iconic bunny ears logo is really very powerful symbol in some other countries, especially apparently in China. Like, they make a huge amount of money just from licensing the logo and the branding. And as gross, honestly, I mean, for as much as I like the idea of a young Hugh Hefner in his smoking jacket and holding his pipe, which he wouldn't smoke because that would be gross, but he would just be kind of holding it in a kind of slightly academic manner, like, that's all very well and sort of inspiring, but that logo is just like, as soon as you see anybody with that logo on their shirt or their coat, you're like, ew, gross, you know. But obviously it is still potent for some people somewhere, and they're just trying to just hold on and just get those last few dollars out of it, but it's clearly doomed.
Yeah, I mean, the history of Playboy is sort of the history of, in some ways, American pop culture up until the last 10 years when it sort of stopped, you know, keeping up. But, you know, most recently it was a reality TV franchise, essentially, with Hefner and his, what was
three
it?
Three girlfriends?
Yeah, who are all, you know, 70 years younger than he was and blonde. And then, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was all plastic surgery. And, you know, and in the 70s, actually, this has sort of tainted any image I had of Playboy as, you know, in any way an interesting place for sexual exploration, because, you know, Bill Cosby, a lot of the women that he, you know, allegedly sexually assaulted, he met at Playboy clubs, and it seemed like, you know, he was close friends with Hugh Hefner, and it just seemed like a pretty seamy scene that, you know, that was sort of drug-fueled and really just the worst kind of treatment of women. So that sort of, for me, you know, is tough to get out of my mind.
Yeah, that sounds like less like the history of pop culture than the history of exploitation of women, or sort of glamorous exploitation of women. That's not quite the right word. But like I was reading, you did, it was interesting, Noreen, because the two big sort of photo spread covers you've done, the one on Bill Cosby for New York Magazine, and then the other one was about the Playboy, the mm-hmm. kind of Playboy bunny nostalgia, I guess.
Yeah, we photographed women in their like 60s, 70s, and 80s who'd been Playboy centerfolds at the current age in sort of lingerie and like looking fantastic, actually, and talking about what it had meant to them.
Now, I thought that the Vanity Fair also did an oral history of Playboy, and I reading some of the things that the women said was actually quite interesting and almost the opposite of what you just described. Like, there's a woman, Catherine Leigh Scott, who was in the Vanity Fair article who says, you could reinvent yourself completely. You went from the schoolgirl to this glam person, and you could be anything. You could put on a French accent, call yourself Fifi. It was a way of discovering yourself and playing around. A great experience when you're 18, 19 years old and exploring your sexuality. That seemed cool.
Yeah, and all the women I talked to for the centerfold story very much had that feeling. They had nothing but positive things to say about Playboy. It was, you know, they got to see the world. They, you know, they went from sort of literally the girl next door to a very glamorous life. And, you know, even some of the women I met from the Cosby thing didn't place the blame at all on Playboy. This is just me sort of adding my own reading of this. But I think the women themselves, actually, particularly the centerfolds we interviewed, kept using the word empowered, that they felt empowered by it, which I thought was fascinating.
Is it fair to say that Playboy opens the door for men entirely controlling a fantasy of women, which in its very early days women feel empowered by or play acting in or feel, you know, relatively safe in, but then it just kind of gets out of control. Like when you move into cocaine 80s mm-hmm. and the reality era, like it just gets uglier and uglier.
I mean, I'm not sure about that. It's always a little ugly, I think, and we just judge it differently. The reality era is not that different in a way from the Playboy Club era in that it was fewer women who got that chance to kind of break through in their from their point of view. I mean, somebody like Kendra, who's still doing reality shows, you know, it's just an opportunity for her, which is kind of what it was for those women who got their photos in the magazine. I don't know that it's any more. It's kind of like the further it recedes into the past and the sort of the softer the edges get in our memories, the kind of the cooler it seems. But I think it's all, you know, it's always been a little bit seamy. It's just it was more important back then because there was something to fight against. I mean, one of the pieces, I think maybe Amanda Hess has pointed out that what really happened is that Hugh Hefner's sort of what was at some point a sort of charming libertarian counterculture view is now pretty much the standard view that we accept and embrace, you know, positive, consensual expressions of sexuality. You know, we don't like censorship, but really what Playboy is doing is choosing to try to survive by self-censorship. So in one way, you know, Hugh Hefner won. And in the other way, the magazine is just kind of, it's just lived out its usefulness, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe there was just a sense that in the old days, it was so serious. You know, it was like something that you had to create that Gloria Steinem would fight against that had elements of empowerment and elements of deep exploitation. Whereas now it just seems like everywhere, ubiquitous, cheap.
My favorite thing about their rebranding, which I think is interesting, is that they are hiring a sex-positive female sex columnist. So I'm interested to see where that goes.
Yeah.
Ugh, those are always boring. I always get excited to read like female sex columnists, and then you're like, wow, this person can really manage to make sex boring. You know, I don't know why, but it happens every, like all those college people who are like, you know, this, like Yale and Harvard, every good college has a sex columnist.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, though. I would never expect any decent sex advice out of a college student unless they were a mature student. I mean, how much sex have they had?
Right.
Don't answer that.
Right. All right, let's move on to our final topic, bangs. But before we do that, Bowl and Branch. We'd like to thank them, a different kind of sheets company. We all spend a third of our life in bed, sleeping on sheets, and we might as well do it right. Bowl and Branch has taught me lots of things, like thread count is a marketing myth, Egyptian cotton, a marketing myth. So be smart. Use Bowl and Branch. It has soft, organic cotton, and also they cut out the middleman, which is the department store markups, which are like 800%, by the way, so you can buy amazing luxury sheets at half the price. They sell only online at bowlandbranch.com. You can't buy it in any stores, which is how they keep the prices low. So you can try them risk-free for 30 nights, and they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping if you go to bowlandbranch.com and use the promo code XX. That's B-O-L-L and BRANCH.com and use the promo code XX spelled out. All right, let's move on to our next topic, bangs. Bangs are ubiquitous. They're as ubiquitous as bang regret. The latest victim is Kate Middleton, who, according to the ever-reliable British tabloids, says she fears her new bangs were a mistake and will embarrass the royal family.
Jesus Christ.
Embarrass
take
the
some
royal
doing.
Family. It is this weird thing, though, about bangs, I have to say. It's like people get bangs and they're like, ta-da, it's like a coming out. And then they're like, oh, shit. You know, it happens so many times. I mean, there are lots and lots of people who are, you know, Taylor Swift, for example, who have bangs, and Noreen Malone. Also Taylor Swift and Noreen Malone, who, and Justin Bieber also, who has a penis and bangs. So but you know what I mean? Like, lots of people just go on happily in their life with their bangs, and that's cool. But then there are just, like, these bang horror moments.
Can we just, like, do the world a favor and define bangs? Because I swear, anytime there's a story about bangs, immediately you get about 17 people saying, do I have bangs?
I think it's called a fringe
in my
Britain.
Country.
It's, you know, a layer of hair that sort of is
sits
somewhere
on top of your
forehead. Yeah.
So I don't have banks, right?
Okay, we need like a Vox article.
You don't have bangs, although you have...
I have hair on my forehead.
Yeah, you have maybe some extremely short bangs.
Okay, cool.
But I wouldn't immediately think June Thomas has bangs.
Okay, cool. All right. See, here's the thing. I don't think bangs go with menswear, which I tend to wear. Like, they're like quintessentially girly, right? I mean, is there something especially feminine about bangs?
It's not exactly feminine. So to me, the quintessential bang person is Betty Page, you know, the pinup 40s artist. Mm-hmm. That's where the look comes from. And she was like somewhat childishly joyous ethos, but also a little bit sexy. Well, like sort of sexy just underneath.
And then there's the Brigitte Bardot kind of bangs, which is, I would say, not very childish, or the Jane Birkin, the sort of European bang.
Right, because even Betty Page, like, she, it was almost the equivalent of a mullet in that she had the bangs in front, but then she had a very complicated hairdo in back. So it was like fringe in front, complication in the back, you know, like,
all right,
it wasn't
no one has ever put Betty Page and mullet in the same sentence except you.
Okay.
Well, okay, that my favorite article that we read about bangs was the one in the Man Repeller, which was why do French girls look cool with bangs and we look like Matilda, which is so true. You know, there is something about the European women bangs where they just like so good. Like it's just so effortless and like the bangs are not like this big kind of like fringe sort of stuck on your forehead, but they go in all different directions in a kind of beautiful way.
It's less hot in Europe, so you don't get the sweaty factor as much.
I disagree with the entire premise.
I'm glad to hear that.
I think you are picturing bangs that are too short, which were kind of a moment, the Betty Page homage. I think that American women maybe do spend a lot of time styling their hair, but I don't think there's anything inherently off about American women's bangs. I also think that it has a lot to do with your face shape, and they look really good on some people and they look not so good on other people, and it's a matter of figuring that out. But what's interesting to me about bangs is the emotionality around them. So I've had bangs probably for the majority of my life, but the moments when I've, you know, grown out my bangs, or then after having grown them out decided to cut them, have, you know, they've always been sort of like fraught moments where I'm like, I just need to change something, you know. And I think it's just the basic thing of you look at your face every day, and that is sometimes where you place some of the dissatisfaction in your life, and you think that just having something different on your face short of, you know, plastic surgery will make everything different in your life. And I think there is this, you know, deep wish in people to be able to do that. And it does feel sort of dramatic, right? You cut bangs and everyone's like, wow, you got bangs. And it just feels like a change has happened in your life.
Oh, so that's why they're so loaded. You know, they're like the sports car or something. Like there's a term, the divorce bangs, right? Like you often read, like Reese Witherspoon had divorce bangs.
I've never read that. That's amazing.
Yeah. So then there's the sense that like you're putting yourself out there and making yourself vulnerable in some obvious way. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a style change that you're trying to be sort of sly and cool about. It's like a very obvious style change right up in your face. You know, like when Beyonce got those truly, 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 truly terrible bangs. I didn't think Michelle Obama's bangs were so bad, but the Beyonce bangs were pretty bad. But I see what you mean. There is a kind of emotional loadedness about bangs that is universal and that other hairstyles don't necessarily have, right? But what if you decided to color your hair black, Noreen? Wouldn't that have the same effect?
Yeah, and I think for some women, like going blonde has the same, you know, sort of spiritual element to it. And I think for men, the equivalent is a beard, you know, the constant thinking about, do I have a beard? Should I grow one? Should I shave one? Nathan Heller, who is an ex-Slatester, wrote a fun piece in The New Yorker on thenewyorker.com recently about the quote-unquote achievement beard, which is like, he cited, I think, David Letterman as the prime example, who's just grown this totally feral beard in his sort of retirement and is wandering the streets of Los Angeles.
I think he's trying to get a job as a Santa Claus.
Yeah, and then there, you know, men have playoff beards and all those kinds of things. So I think there is something with hair on your face, like being symbolic to humans.
Right. Okay. All right. Cavemen.
Cavemen. Cave women. Hannah, have you had beards? Or have you had a beard? No, have you had bangs ever?
Here's my thing about bangs. I really want to have bangs. I do. I covet bangs. I deeply covet bangs.
Why? Because they look kind of cool?
I don't know. I just think they're cool.
Yeah. You're kind of European. You could totally get away with
it. No,
that.
I just doesn't. It's my nose. Like, I just, like, as James Wood once said, when he and I were both wearing hats, he was like, nose on a stick. Like, there's just, you look, like, there's just something wrong when some, like, it just would come exactly to the top of my long and pointy nose and look funny. And then I tried to get my daughter to get bangs, but she has a really short forehead, so it doesn't work either. So there's going to be no bangs in my life. I'm sorry.
Can you get pups to get bangs?
He did an achievement beard. Uh-huh. Like, he's like, I'm a CEO now. I will have a beard, you know. And there was actually a story about CEOs with beards. So he wins the Rosenplatz Household Face Hair Midlife Crisis Award.
Excellent. Noreen, I've got a question for you. I keep reading in all the bang literature, which is extensive, there's very divided advice on whether you should trim your own bangs after you've had a few drinks.
Oh my God, it's great. Okay, so I actually no longer trim my own bangs because I no longer trust myself.
Because you're a fancy lady now. No,
maybe. I mean, some hair salons will give you a free bang trim if you're a client, but I have definitely trimmed my own bangs at various periods in time, and definitely I think 1.5 glasses of wine is the optimum amount of alcohol you should consume. It's just enough that you feel empowered to change something about your face, and not enough that you are, you know, ruining it.
I'm going to poke yourself in the eye.
Yeah, that's another bar science recommendation. 1.5 glasses of alcohol to trim your own bangs.
So what do you mean? To trim your bangs from having no bangs, or to trim your your bangs that you all already have? Because the no bangs to bangs,
don't do that yourself. No. To trim your own bangs. Although in college, I did let a friend. I had you know, post-adolescence grown out my bangs. I was an adult. I didn't want bangs anymore. And then in college, my friend was like, I want to cut some bangs. And I was like, okay, go to town. And they were pretty bad. So that was my look for a while.
I wish I had a picture of that. I thought that the Slate did a great roundup of all the staffers and their child bang phase. And it was extremely charming and cute.
It was really, really, cute. Really cute. And there was a lot of anti-bang sentiment. And I just want to shout out Amanda Hess, who was sort of the close of that piece and said that she cannot imagine her face without bangs or something to that effect. And she just held it down for the pro-bang lobby.
Yeah.
Actually, what she said was, she said, bangs forever. It was cute. Well, listeners, if you've got any special stories to tell us about your bangs, please do, especially cutting your own bangs. And you can even post a picture of your child self with bangs. We would love to see it. Let's move on to recommendations. But before we do that, we are going to listen to a message from another sponsor, the GE Podcast Theater.
Hi, Nikki Tomlin here, and I'm the host of The Message. I'm going to take you into an elite cryptography think tank and check it out. Their top project right now is to decode a highly classified radio transmission from the 1940s.
Have you listened to it yet?
Not yet. We're having a discussion about that. But if I offered you the chance to listen to it right now... Sounds like a no.
Well, we don't really know what it is. Voices, music, breathing. But, you know, I'm not going to mess with that thing.
To sum it up, extraterrestrials. Subscribe to The Message on iTunes.
June, why don't you go first?
So I have a recommendation which is a little bit mixed. The show Madam Secretary started airing on CBS last year. It's in its second season now. And before it started, there was a lot of sort of fuss about, oh my goodness, is it a stealth ad for Hillary because it's about a female Secretary of State and her travails? And in the first season, it absolutely was not anything to do with Hillary. It was not very realistic. It was watchable, and it came back for a second season, and I think the family stuff was pretty good. But as anything bearing, it bore no relation to the life of an actual Secretary of State. Now, as it's come back for its second season, I think it's actually gotten a little bit more realistic and a little bit more serious about the workplace side of things. And I've definitely gotten more interested in it. I can tell this because I came back from a trip on Sunday night and I had not been able to watch television for several days. So I had a bunch of programs lined up on my TiVo. And the one that I chose to watch, because I only had 1 hour, was the latest edition, or the latest Madam Secretary. Tia Leone plays Bess, the Secretary of State. And I think it's not a really good show, but it's a watchable show. And sometimes...
There's a blurb.
Yeah, like sometimes those shows, like sometimes you need those. Like you don't always want like something that you're totally enthusiastic about that you're going to pay 100% attention to. You just want like a good, decent show. And that's what this is. And it's actually getting better. So it might even move to a different category.
That's so funny. I don't have that category of show, I don't think. And I was wondering what to think about that show. Or maybe I do have it. I'm going to think hard now this week. Is there any shows I like because they're just watchable and I don't have to... Oh, yeah, there is. Nashville.
I love Nashville.
But you love Nashville.
No,
I just feel
but
Nashville is like, all right, I'm going to watch some Nashville, especially in its later years. You know, it's just kind of on and David loves it. And so I can kind of half watch it and half do other stuff.
It's not good. It's like decompression television. But I love a soap and I love country music. Yeah. And Connie Britton's hair.
Yeah.
She had bangs in the 90s. If anyone wants to Google an amazing bang image, Connie Britton bangs when she was on news radio. Curly bangs.
Noreen, you and David have very similar taste. You often like and dislike the same things.
Interesting.
It's a sort of kind of sentimentality that you both share, I think. Okay, I have two recommendations. One is Thy Neighbor's Wife, the Gates Lees book. It is my favorite nonfiction book ever. And I recommend it this week because it's about Hugh Hefner. I mean, it's alternating chapters about Hugh Hefner and about just kind of people living through the sexual revolution. So it's such a fantastic book. The second, I really want to have a discussion with our listeners and maybe with you guys, if you're willing, about Jonathan Franzen and purity and his attitude towards women. I'm very curious, and you can email me, listeners. I know that the lead character is a woman, and she's by far the most fully realized character in that book and quite sympathetic. But there's such like a hatred of women running through that book, such an extremity of behavior by women that I'm just puzzled by it and wondering if people are like alarmed by it, if they accept it, if they think it's expressing something genuine in the modern man who feels a certain way of being controlled by women and made to do things by women, like pee sitting down is one moment in the book. But Jonathan Franzen and women is a conversation I want to have.
Well, let's actually have it. I read that
book.
It's
just interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Maybe we'll have it. Noreen, your turn.
I've been listening to... a Panoply Rivals podcast that I've been enjoying quite a bit. I know. So Startup Season 2 on the Gimlet Radio Network. So Startup Season 1, I think, got a lot of attention because it was a podcast about this guy starting his own podcast network. So it was very meta. Startup Season 2, which is over, but still available on the internet, is about two women in their early 20s trying to start or expand a dating website. And it's really interesting if you're interested in anything involving tech or startups, if you're interested in dating, you know, in the issues of trying to figure out how their app will work. They get into racial bias in dating, you know, sort of looks bias in dating in general. And then they talk a lot about, you know, the difficulty of being a woman in Silicon Valley. And it's good radio. So check it out. Startup Season 2.
How about if you're interested in like how much women cry when they're starting a website as opposed to Season 1? There was just a lot of crying in Season 2.
A lot of emotionality.
Yeah. So much. I was like, the gender difference between Season 1 and Season 2, while not explicit, is stark, you know? Just like the amount of emotions in Season 2 and just like relational drama, you know?
Well, yes. I don't mean for what I'm about to say to sound condescending. I think it might. But I also think that the fact that they are... you know, 24 versus Season 1, those men were, you know, I think in their 40s or 50s. I think just people, it's easier to run a business when you have experience. But a lot of people who are starting companies now are really young. So it's super fascinating. Anyway, the startup is The Dating Ring, and I guess it's not a startup anymore. I don't know. And the show is Startup.
Yeah, I actually binge listened to that when I was driving around Colorado in the summer. All right. Once again, we are looking for an intern. If you're interested, please email us xxgabfest@slate.com with intern in the subject line. And we are looking for people who are able to sit in on our tapings in New York or D.C.
Thanks to our fabulous producer, Anne Hepperman, Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and our intern, Jesse Chasen Tabor. The Double X Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. To find out more about the show, go to our show page, slate.com/xx. Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabFest. Tell us about your relationship with either Playboy or Bangs. That was not a sexual reference. Email xxgabfest@slate.com and subscribe to us on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Welcome to the crying game where you lose your soul. Where it ain't no easy pass, you gotta use the toll. Ain't no cruise control, you about to lose.